Welcome to the Everything Podcast, the place for everything education. Whether you're a first-year teacher or a seasoned educator, our mission is to help you employ smart strategies in and out of the classroom.
We firmly believe that teacher burnout isn't inevitable. Part inspiration and part implementation, we discuss the why and how to make your classroom effective and sustainable.
We're your hosts, Danielle
and Nicole. Welcome back to another episode of the Everything Podcast. We have an awesome show for you today. I am so excited to welcome our friend Maria Helton onto our podcast. Danielle and I have been huge fans of Maria for so long. Perhaps you know Maria from her podcast, her Instagram, her blog. She is a wealth of knowledge, not just for teachers, but for administrators, for staff, for schools in general, for parents. She offers so, so much. She is a behavior specialist who works in public schools, supporting teachers with classroom management, as well as incorporating behavior and social emotional learning strategies into daily teaching. Whether you are interacting with your students virtually or in person, Maria, she does it. She explains how to cultivate the behavior we want to see in our students, and we want our students to display. From building rapport to coping mechanisms, Maria demonstrates the need to model behavior, to be cognizant of providing reinforcement for the behaviors we want to see more of, and to meet students' needs at the moment, rather than rushing to find blame or consequences. While there are certainly unique challenges in terms of behavior that arise in the virtual environment schools may find themselves in 2020, Maria's optimism shines through, seeing this as an opportunity to leave behind the relics of traditional school punishments and instead think of new, creative ways that more appropriately set students up for long-term success in whatever environment they find themselves in. Let's welcome Maria onto our show. And we are so very excited to welcome our new friend, Maria. Welcome, Maria.
Hi.
We're so happy to have you on today. And for those that are familiar with Maria on Instagram, she's known as Teaching Behavior Together and TPT, her blog, her podcast. She's got so much going on. And we're so excited to talk about all the things.
I'm so excited to be here. I love your podcast. Been listening for a while. So I'm really excited to be a guest on the show.
That means a lot to us. Really, really does. So we definitely want to dive in just to learn more about you. And of course, we meet you at an interesting time because we're all thinking about our back to school plans and what it means to be a teacher in 2020 and just all that's happening. And we'd love to hear a bit about your day-to-day now and what your next couple of weeks and months look like.
Sure. So back to school has already started for me. We are doing a lot of professional development right now and just focusing on best practices for teaching virtually. And my role has been mainly focused on how to help teachers support behaviors in their virtual classrooms and working around the accessibilities that we have now that we're virtual and focusing on how we can increase those desired behaviors just like we would in a classroom, but just with new strategies and new intervention techniques so that our students are maximizing their success.
I imagine that is just a huge responsibility. Yes. And you've done a lot of adapting to what your, I guess, more traditional job looks like. And would you mind kind of giving us like a side-by-side? How does that compare to maybe what your 2019, 2018 school day looked like up until now?
Sure. So prior to everything, my day-to-day was basically really supporting teachers in the classroom, but also helping with behavioral supports for students who had more intense behavioral needs. So doing functional behavior assessments and writing behavior intervention plans. And my day-to-day will still be a lot like that. It's just joining a lot of virtual classrooms now, taking a lot of data and really focusing on the behaviors that have changed. So different things we want to increase now as opposed to when we were in person and different things that we're seeing pop up that we want to teach those new replacement skills for so our students are able to be successful in this environment. So it'll be pretty much the same as just focusing on different behaviors and working with teachers in a capacity of not being able to see each other face to face, not being able to go into their classroom and look at the physical layout and the visuals that are around because right now our classrooms are like 4x4 square of our faces and not the physical classroom the warm, inviting place that we typically see? And how can we make our virtual classrooms warm and inviting? How can we build rapport with our students? And really just focusing on those things all happening virtually.
There's so much of that that we need to just go into and unpack. And I imagine that in order to create the behaviors that we want to see, the beginning of the year, no matter what that looks like, is probably one of the most crucial times.
It definitely is. It's definitely when the most powerful behavioral strategy I always tell teachers is to build relationships. And I think that we hear that a lot. And it's also like, well, what does that really mean? Like, how do I build relationships? You're going to build relationships differently with each kid, and really figuring out like how you can connect with your students. And that gets harder and harder as kids get older, when kids have 7 or 8 teachers in a day and teachers are teaching the 300 students plus a day. That can be really hard to build all those relationships, but taking time and space in your teaching just to focus on other student interests, or building in that interest into your class and your teaching, can really be helpful for building relationships. And it can just be a really quick check-in as well. And I also tell teachers not to put a lot of pressure on yourself to have a relationship with a kid in a week, because that's not how relationships are built. They're built over time. We have to really establish trust with students and make sure that they know that we're there for them. And that's just done through repeated, constantly showing up for our students, and that consistency of being there for them. And the relationship will come. And we have to work with the behaviors until that happens. And even if we have a really strong relationship, that doesn't mean no behaviors will happen, but it means when they do happen that we are better equipped to meeting those students' needs.
I imagine so much of what you teach teachers and the way that you encourage them to have great relationships with their students. I imagine you're working on the way that you collaborate and work with teachers at the same time. So as much as you're teaching about how to work with kids, a lot of that really great relationship building and foundation comes from your relationships, your collaborations with teachers. You have a lot of experience in that kind of collaborative relationship, that collaborative kind of structure in kind of coaching teachers and helping them. How does that look on a day-to-day basis? Are you kind of like walking through as like the school year progresses to help teachers? I'd love to know more about that kind of relationship, because I imagine so much of that is mimicked by the relationships that they have with their students.
Definitely. So in ABA, we have this concept called pairing, and typically pairing is done with like for students who find something aversive. So if a student finds a particular activity aversive, we pair it with something that they really enjoy, right? And we want our students to associate us with something that they enjoy. We want them to find us reinforcing. And that it sounds kind of super contrived when you talk about it that way, but essentially, I never want to walk into a classroom, say, here's a behavior plan, this is what we're doing, like, see you later, let me know how it's going. I want to walk into a classroom and be very open to the teacher's ideas. Like, that's how I frame all of my behavior plans is, or classroom management plans, is what can you feasibly do in your classroom? What are your needs? What do you want to focus on? And build that relationship and pair myself essentially as a reinforcer. I never want to walk into a classroom and be this person that's putting extra demands on teachers, because teachers deal with a lot of demands on a daily basis, especially this year. We're all getting used to new demands, and me coming in and adding an extra demand is almost an automatic way for that relationship not to start off on a good foot. But also just being human and just being real with teachers, you know, and not being the person that sits in my office and sits behind a computer and types up all the reports, but goes into teacher's room just to talk to them about how their day is in the teacher's lounge and in the hallway and stuff, which I think is what teachers try and do as well, you know, stop by and talk to a student at lunch, catch them in the hallway while they're walking to the next class, you know, check in with them right before class starts, something like that, just to see and make sure that they know that my support is there for them, and that even though I don't get to come in their classroom every day because I am split between multiple buildings, that they can always reach me and that I'm always there and that their voices are heard and their concerns are valid and no behavior is too small to work on. and to really support in the classroom, especially when, especially as a teacher, if you feel that there are behaviors that we can start increasing to really maximize student success, that's what I like to focus on, is what skills can we help our students develop so that they're more successful in the future.
What you said reminded me so much of what my husband said when he was a guest on our podcast. He is in IT at a school. And when he came in, he said very similarly, like, so many of the staff members seem to think that, like, I'm, you know, removed and I'm just like sitting at a computer waiting to be called. And it's not exactly like that. And that's not the relationship that I want to have with the teachers either. You had mentioned, like, no behavior is too small. How can teachers take the first step in order to, like, make a great relationship with whoever their behavioral specialist may be?
Yeah, sure. Just reaching out to them and saying, like, hey, I have this going on in my classroom. Is there a way you can stop by? And not feeling bad about asking for help. You know, that's what my whole job is there for, is to help teachers. It's what I went to school for, to help support teachers so that our students are able to reach their full capacity. And that's what I love to do. I love going into classrooms, and pretty much all behavior specialists that I talk to, we love going to classrooms and really just focusing on how can we make this environment a place where all students are succeeding. And, you know, not that teachers have these classrooms that are on fire or anything like that, but there are aspects of a classroom that we can simply tweak. And the first thing I always look for is physical layout out of a classroom. If a teacher's desk is super far on the corner and they're always having issues at one of the centers or stations, all we can do is, like, move the desk to the middle, and then you have, like, eyes on the whole room, and you might see some of those decreases where I think sometimes it's really intimidating to focus on behaviors because we have so many academic targets we're trying to hit, but at the same time, behaviors can really interfere with us hitting those academic targets. So not being afraid to ask for help and not being afraid that your concern is seen as silly, because I haven't heard of a silly concern yet. So
I love that. I think that not being afraid to ask for help and, you know, being able to understand that wanting to contact behavior specialists is not something you have to do as, like, the very last step after you've tried all of the things, right? Having a collaborative effort from the very beginning. And I'm sure they want to call Maria immediately. They're like, all right, let's get her on the phone. That's wonderful.
I much prefer that than waiting to the very last minute, because at that point, the behavior's been so reinforced. Right. It can be really hard to reverse that. And it can be really hard for our students. So if we can get it, like, right at the get-go and put a really good proactive plan in place, it can be really effective.
And I'd love to touch on that in particular, because we see you at this time where we're all thinking about our back to school plans. We're all thinking virtual, in person, hybrid, whatever that might mean. But no matter what, we want to start the school off with a really strong behavior plan, I guess you could say, whatever kind of setting you're in. Doesn't, I guess, really matter so much as you want to come in with the right mindset and have the right rules and expectations. And I'd love to know your takeaways with that and how, as teachers, we can walk into the school year or log into the school year with the best mindset.
So what I've been trying to focus on is, we all have, like, a trial run of virtual learning, whether you're going back fully in person, hybrid, or fully online. You know, in each of those settings, what some of the concerns that you were having in terms of behavior. So was it that you had lower attendance than you were expecting? It's harder for students to get online. Or was it that students didn't really know how to engage appropriately? So there was a lot of disruptions. Really identifying one thing that was a concern of yours and flipping that to, what skills can I teach my students so that's no longer a concern? I typically write all of my classroom management behavior plans focused on what skills can we be teaching. And because we're going to be in a new environment, or some aspects of school are going to look differently, we're going to have to teach some new skills. And focusing on how we're going to teach those skills, I err on the side of always teaching them very explicitly and practicing them. I usually utilize the model for teaching skills is called behavioral skills training, where we tell our students something about the skill, like if it's engaging appropriately in your classroom, so not disrupting. I would tell them, you know, when we're all learning and we're trying to be engaged, it's really distracting when you're talking to another student or you're talking to someone in the background, and that can interrupt our learning. And you tell them the why. We all want to be here. We all want to learn as much as we can. We have limited time together. And then I model that appropriate behavior. We give the students a lot of time to practice. We give them a lot of reinforcement for engaging in that skill. And when we're first teaching skills, we really want to be heavy on the reinforcement. And some teachers can be a little bit hesitant of that because it's daunting having to provide so much reinforcement right at the beginning. But when we're teaching any skill, we have to provide a lot of reinforcement because that's how that skill builds. And then we can fade that out. So having a plan for, okay, so I'm really engaging my students. They're doing so well with the engagement. We have a lot of positive engagement and not a lot of disruptions. Let's keep this going. And then you can slowly fade that out. It doesn't have to be a forever thing that you're providing so much reinforcement and you're focusing so much on that skill. And then really focusing on, again, that reinforcement. But if you do, and I hate the word consequences, and anyone that's listened to my podcast knows I hate this word because it has such a negative connotation that consequences mean punishment. But if you do have to work with a student because they're disrupting the learning environment or whatever, focusing on natural and logical consequences as opposed to super contrived consequences. And I think one advantage of virtual learning is that we have to kind of get rid of our old consequences. There's no recess to take away anymore. There's no detention. There's no in-school suspension to provide. So thinking about what's a logical consequence for that behavior. So if it was disruptive, I always focus on logical consequences being skill building. So the logical consequence to you being disruptive in my class is that we're going to work on the skill of engagement together. And not saying that should be a punishment in any way, but obviously this student needs some extra help, some extra support. And typically if you're working with a student on a skill like that, you're also developing a relationship with them and really finding out, you know, why are you so disruptive in class? And not to mean that to sound in a bad way, but you know, are you having trouble focusing? Like, how can I help support you? You find out a lot more about their behavior and you're able to support them in different ways when you spend time one-on-one or in a small group of students really focusing on that skill building that you can kind of scaffold up. So that's what I really am trying to help teachers focus on right now is what skills can we be teaching? How can we reinforce those skills? And how can we really set our students up for success as opposed to focusing on the behaviors we wanted to decrease? Because if we're focused on skills we want to increase, those behaviors will decrease automatically. Kids can't be disruptive and academically engaged at the same time, you know, appropriately. So
I love how you put that. And for Danielle and I are both high school teachers, and to kind of have that little reminder as well is helpful. I think so often, I won't speak for you, Danielle, but I feel like when it comes to the consequences piece, it tends to be that contrived kind of, well, what's a typical way, or what's the school's mm-hmm. idea of this? But it really is about teaching that positive behavior. And if they're really, I mean, I can speak to what it was like virtual learning in the spring, and attendance was an issue for me for sure. So trying to kind of navigate that as we go back into our new model of the school year, it's a great way to, first of all, identify what was a challenge. And if you're a new teacher listening to this, perhaps you want to head to a Facebook group or an online group that would kind of give you a sense of what maybe was some of the peaks and valleys of virtual learning, to kind of give a sense of what you might be able to anticipate. But I think that's really helpful to try and see your plan as not just being, well, I have to expect everything and expect the unexpected mm-hmm. and all the things that I don't know, but instead try and really navigate based on what you know about the environment and what you may not, or you may or may not have experienced yourself, trying to identify the way that you want to really pinpoint how you'd like to instruct behavior. And I think that's mm-hmm. a really great reminder. So thank you for that.
Sure. Yeah. High school is definitely a completely different sector of figuring out what's reinforcing for our high school students, because what works in elementary school does not work in high school, because high school students have so much that they can access on their own, right? So in elementary school, we're focusing on you know, stickers and small items, or, you know, lunch with the principal and stuff. And those are all really fun and exciting. And in high school, that's not so fun and exciting. And they want time with their friends. And especially in this virtual environment, they have access to all of that stuff, not in the same way, but they can text their friends, they can FaceTime their friends and stuff like that. So how do we find something reinforcing in our virtual classrooms for them? And I've never met a high school student that doesn't like to share and talk about what they have going on, and just, you know, engage with their peers, and allowing as many opportunities as that as possible can be a really powerful reinforcer.
So I'd love to talk about, in terms of being in person and the ways in which we interact with students, and just really kind of narrowing down on teaching that positive behavior, and those who may have experienced having a student who is having an issue. And as a teacher, you're responsible for de-escalating that situation, mm-hmm. and trying your best to handle that along with other students and all of that. And there are so many examples we could give, but I'd love to know, first off, what your kind of attitude about that type of interaction might be when you either hear something like that going on, or you've heard from another teacher about an incident that they have. Kind of like walk us through what you might say to a teacher, how you might coach them through something. And of course, all these situations look really different, but in terms of being in person, I'd love to know how you would respond to a teacher.
Yeah, for sure. So in person, I think we all have to agree that we're all operating on a little higher level of anxiety when we're walking into our buildings, and giving that grace to our students. But, you know, if a situation does arise where a student does become escalated and a student has to de-escalate a student's behavior, I always focus on meeting that student's needs in that moment. So I know when a student's behavior becomes escalated, it can be very anxiety provoking for teachers and the adults in that classroom. And everyone wants it to be over very quickly. No one wants to see a student struggling with their behavior in that way. And we want to hurry up and get that student to calm down so that they feel better. And knowing that it might not be a very quick process, and allowing that student to express their needs and wants in that moment, and meeting those needs and wants. So we see that a student might be frustrated, a student doesn't want to wear their mask, or a student really wants to talk to their friend, or, you know, whatever the new behaviors that we're going to see entering into a physical environment in the fall are going to be, and they become upset and frustrated because this is all new, and we're telling them no to things that they previously could do, and putting all of these boundaries and restrictions in place in our schools, and that can be upsetting to a lot of our students. So if a student does become, or the behavior becomes escalated, focusing on listening to what that student is saying in the moment. So if they're saying they're mad, upset, and then offering support, but offering support in a very, this, and I always tell teachers, this sounds really bad, but in a very non-wordy way. Like, we want to be very simple with our instructions or how we're offering support in that moment, because whenever we're elevated, we have a hard time processing verbal information. So if we're saying to a student, I know that you're really upset, I'm really upset too, and it really stinks that we have to wear our masks, and maybe during this time you won't have to wear your mask, and it's just very wordy like that, a student's not really going to be able to comprehend and understand that and then produce an outcome for you. So it's going to look like they're not complying with what you're asking, when in reality they might not really understand. So keeping it very simple and short, and just saying, I know this stinks. We don't have to like really elaborate on it at that moment, and validating their feelings. No student wants to hear in the moment, you know, I don't want to wear my mask, and no student wants to hear, well, it's too bad. You know, like, we have to wear a mask, you know, we don't have a choice. They want to say, yeah, it stinks. You know, you want, when you're upset, you want someone just to be there and say, yeah, this is not fun. And we can all relate to that. So giving the student that grace in that moment, and then not trying to figure out a specific solution right in that moment. Let the student de-escalate, calm down. Once the student's fully calm, come back to the situation and say, next time you want to take your mask off and you get upset, what can we do differently? And making a plan, and then making sure that we're helping the student engage in that plan. Because even if I sit down with a student one-to-one and say, next time you're upset about wearing your mask, you can go out in the hallway and take it off, the student might not be able to do it the very next time they're upset about their mask, because this is still a very new skill for them. So, you know, prompting them throughout the day, hey, remember, if you're getting upset or uncomfortable, just go out in the hallway, take your mask off, come back in when you're ready, that type of thing, so that we're reminding the student, prompting the student, so that they're able to be successful with that and not as frustrated. I don't know if that answered your question, but really focusing on those things, and then making sure as an adult, after a student's behavior's been escalated and you've had that heightened level of anxiety, processing it with you, yourself, and the staff in the room, and recognizing that it's no one's fault. You know, we're all doing the best that we can, and no teacher that I've ever met intentionally engages in something that's going to escalate a student's behavior. And I know a lot of times we often think that nothing happens before students' behavior escalates, but something always does. It's not always apparent to us. As we go through this process, we can learn about our students' triggers and help diminish those, but it's not going to be perfect. You know, no one can be perfect, and we're all trying the best that we can. It's no one's fault. And reaching out to a behavior specialist if this is something that's happening a lot in your classroom, and figuring out, does a student need a more individualized plan, or do we need to be doing some different interventions with that student as well? So those are all things that I think would be helpful. And knowing also that as teachers, we're walking into the building with heightened levels of anxiety, and not being too hard on ourselves and giving ourselves grace too.
Unsurprisingly, everything that you mentioned really reminds me of the conversations we've had on the podcast and with in her presentations. Amanda Murtaugh, she's a licensed mental health professional and close personal friend of mine. She's been on to talk to us about how we can help students deal with stressors and how we as teachers can deal with all the stressors that we, you know, encounter regularly. And you're bringing up a bunch of things that are new to everybody and are going mm-hmm. to cause that, you know, increased level of anxiety. And I happen to know that you teach coping skills pretty well. So could you give us maybe a little bit of insight about why we should teach coping skills and how to do that, if that's not something we've ever like explicitly taught before?
Mm-hmm. So I have a whole podcast episode on how to teach coping skills. I also have a free guide that you can go to my website and download. It's just teachingbehaviortogether.com, and it walks you through the 6 steps to teach coping skills. Really, I would focus on identifying coping skills that are feasible in your classroom. So if the coping skills that you're going to teach are deep breathing, sitting on a yoga ball, playing with Play-Doh, drawing a picture, just really identifying those things and then teaching that skill explicitly to a student. So we might all think that a student can bounce on a yoga ball, and they probably all can, but still spending that time and teaching them, when you're bouncing on this yoga ball, this is what you're supposed to be doing to calm your body, and teaching them how to enter and exit the learning environment when they are going to engage in a coping skill, and how that they're going to let you know that that's what they're doing. I like using break cards, particularly just giving each student like a little laminated card that they can put on their desk saying like, I'm on a break, and that they can then go and do whatever activity is going to help calm themselves in that moment. If you have a calm down corner, that's really great. Not everyone has room for a calm down corner. I haven't even thought of how calm down corners would work now with items in them and cleaning them and everything like that. But providing students with an area that they can go to, even if that's just right outside your classroom door. A lot of students don't necessarily want to be calming down right in front of their peers. So if it can be a little bit more of a private area, that can be really helpful. And focusing on reinforcing those skills. So once you see that a student has successfully calmed down, providing them with a lot of praise and letting them know, like, you did that. You noticed that you were becoming upset. You appropriately asked for a break or to go to the calm down corner, and then you came back and you were ready to learn, and really acknowledging that with the student. Because when we're learning new skills, we have to really establish that contingency path of, I felt like this before, I did this behavior, and now I felt better. And that doesn't come naturally to all of our students. It doesn't come naturally to a lot of us. I know, like, I tried meditation a lot. Doesn't work for me, and that's fine. And also letting our students know, like, not everything's going to work for you. You know, some students just need to put their head down and not do anything. Some students need to physically be doing something to take their mind off of whatever made them upset. Some students want to talk, and so they want to go on a walk with somebody so that they can process or vent about it. And in the episode that I did on my podcast, I also talked about expanding our view of what's an appropriate calm down strategy, right? Not everyone would agree that a student stomping their feet down the hallway is an appropriate calm down strategy. But if that's what's working for them, let's do that for now and then work towards a more appropriate calm down strategy in the future. Because our goal is to get them to calm down. And yes, stomping their feet can be disruptive, but if we can slowly work with that, right? We can stomp our feet all the way down the hallway, and then as we're being successful with that, we can stomp our feet just halfway down the hallway and then walk appropriately. And then maybe we just get 3 or 4 stomps right when we're right outside of the door and kind of fade that back, but really expanding our view on what's appropriate, what's acceptable, and what's realistically going to help our students calm down. Because I know for a lot of high school students, especially, deep breaths is not always going to work. Some of our students really need to vent, and letting them know, hey, you can go and vent, and I'm not going to judge you for what you say. I'm not going to judge you for how mad you are about it. But if that's what's going to help you calm down, that's the main goal. And we can work on shaping that to be more appropriate once we've established that you can appropriately engage in one of these skills.
And for those that are looking for that explicit instruction on how to actually teach these coping skills and maybe even a product that's available, is there any particular resource they can turn to?
Sure. I also have on my website, if you like scroll down to the bottom of it, there's also a free calm down kit. So if you are looking to set up a calm down corner in your classroom, I do have a kit with a bunch of visuals. It's more appropriate for younger grades, but there's a bunch of visuals in there, prompts for students, directional cards that they can utilize when they are in the calm down corner. So if you're looking for that, you can find both of those things on my website as well.
Wonderful. Even at a high school level, I feel like hearing about these strategies is so useful, right? Because at the high school level, I think a lot of times we expect our students to know how to do these things, and that can be problematic in and of itself because not all students did have those foundations. And therefore, we're starting with conflict, which we don't need to have. And if we even go a step further, maybe students are a little bit more aware and they are able to utilize some of these things, but making sure that we have a strategy for allowing them to take that. They know themselves well enough to know, I need that, what is that 30 seconds of just put my head down on my desk and then I can pick my head back up. That's fine. But communicating that to me so that way I know that I don't need to ask if they need to go to the nurse and now I'm escalating the situation. I think that would be a really great strategy that is certainly applicable.
Yes, that's what I definitely like, break cards at the high school level. And for high schools that have like specific passes, I know some high schools have like each teacher gets like a high school pass, like a school pass, like the mascot on or whatever, but also giving some of our students that need those extra breaks throughout the day or might be struggling with something in particular, they have their own pass so that they are able to leave the classroom. Because something that I see a lot at the high school level is everyone wants the pass. And if you're gone with the pass too long and you come back in the classroom, it's all like, why were you gone so long? And that can also escalate a situation. So giving a student the opportunity to not use the class pass, and they get to use this pass that they have themselves, that people in the hallway recognize the student's on a break. They, you know, are processing something. It also signals to other adults maybe not to talk to them at that moment. You know, if they see one of those passes, they know that a student is upset about something, and typically students will know who they can go to, or we can help them establish who they can go to. And a random teacher in the hallway asking them where they're supposed to be might not be the best thing for them in that moment. So they can be really effective in a lot of different ways, and they don't have to be super obvious either for our students, because that's another concern at the middle school and high school level is everyone knowing, you know, that you're upset, and we don't want that either. So middle school and high school is a complicated behavior place to be, that's for sure.
I couldn't agree more. But I really think that a lot of these things are not limited to the elementary level. So thank you for sharing so many tips and tactics that are useful no matter what grade level you teach, no matter if you're starting in person or not, or hybrid, or all of the things. So I took a ton of notes.
Me too. And really, Maria, I think that this is such a great refresh. Of course, we go into the new school year thinking how we're going to approach things. And it goes without saying that things look a bit different this year. But I think the part that at least I wasn't really thinking about very explicitly was needing to now teach new kinds of skills and not just how to interact online, but actually how to cope and manage with all the change that's coming up. And I think even as teachers, we have to learn how to cope and manage, and we're all doing our best, right? But having a reminder about this kind of explicit instruction that's really not just a back to school kind of procedure, but a true reminder that we're all going through a lot of shifts in our day to day and with the level of anxiety that we're maybe accustomed to, and having that increase just a bit. But we really appreciate your podcast and your blog for being such a great resource for teachers that are looking for a perspective of a professional who has experience in what is a more traditional setting, right? Being in school in person and now making this adjustment to online. So I know that your resources will continue to be an active part of how people really update and continue to learn about how to make the most of teaching behavior. So thank you for all that you do.
Yes, of course. I mean, this is literally my dream job. I'm lucky enough to have my dream job, and I love what I do. I spent a lot of time in school thinking that this job might never exist because behavior specialists typically work in the homes, and I'm lucky enough to be in a district that has behavior specialists. And if you don't work in a district that has one, ask for one, because it's becoming more and more popular. It's becoming more and more of a thing in districts. Just, you know, email your student support coordinator, whatever it might be, and let them know, like, other districts are doing this. And it could be a really great resource, because there's plenty of people out there that have this, the same desire to be in schools and helping teachers support behaviors, because it allows our students to be really successful through elementary, middle school, and high school.
Now, I do have a question. When we had Macy on, and she is an occupational therapist, and she was talking about, she actually, before all of this happened and everybody has now gone remote, her occupational therapy occurs all online because she services communities that are in really remote areas. Is that something that is happening with behavioral specialists? Might be something that is occurring? I'm just curious.
Yeah, definitely. So there's plenty of behavior specialists that I know that service remote or rural districts. And a lot of it happens online. A lot of help happens via telehealth, because it depends on how your district's going to hire them. But because I'm like a board certified behavior analyst, some districts go about hiring through also being able to bill insurance. So it depends on like all of that stuff that I don't really understand. I don't bill insurance. My district doesn't. So not that I know of.
That might be available to schools. So if they don't seem open to it right away, maybe there's a less traditional approach that your school could take to still making sure that we get people like you in our classrooms to give these great insights.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely ways to do it. And it's becoming a lot more popular than it was even a couple of years ago.
Which is great news.
Great is. I think your episode 18 may touch on that exact topic about how to become a specialist.
And it does. I get that question all the time.
I bet. Well, it's a valid question, especially as we're all navigating what's new, but it's an invaluable resource at a school. So we really appreciate your perspective, not having the access to a behavior specialist at my district. So this has really been such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And definitely make sure that you shout out all the places people can connect with you and continue to learn from you.
Sure. So the easiest way to connect with me is on Instagram at Teaching Behavior Together. I have a podcast called the Teaching Behavior Together Podcast. And my website is teachingbehaviortogether.com. And if you're looking for resources or units that you can utilize to teach some of the skills that we talked about, I do have a Teachers Pay Teacher store, Teaching Behavior Together. So
great. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about us and the services that we offer, head to everything.com.